Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Your Honor.
If country borders and grids can fascinate you, and state names intrigue you, if atlases, globes, city plans, subway maps, and of course, world maps are your thing, if you can name the capital city of Namibia, and if you get giddy about flags, you are in the right place. This is Map Corner, a podcast about the love of maps brought to you by Royfield Brown and Claire Asprey. Now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Map Corner. I'm Royfield Brown, who is Wadham Coastal Exchanges, yet again, or for the more conventionally minded, 33.8044 degrees north or 122.1212 degrees west, which puts me back in lovely Oakland. Oh, I love Oakland. The sun is out, the sky is blue. This place does not have a winter. And with me, I have the map mistress, who is Claire Asprey. Where are you today, Claire?
I'm in my normal 52.1 degrees north and minus 0.5 degrees west, Clapham, Bedfordshire, where it is definitely winter.
I've never thought about it before, but the very fact that you're minus, that means that you are just to the east of the Greenwich Meridian.
Yes, indeed. Must be. Only very, very marginally, though.
Yeah, very marginally. Like, if I was looking at a map and where I think that you are, I'd have put you slightly to the west, but there you go. All that curvature of the earth and all of that, you're just very slightly to the east. Anyway,
yeah, well, you're not listening when we talked about 2 degrees west last time.
Claire, I've probably listened to that interview more than anybody because I edited the Mumma Jamma. So don't be having a go at me. But folks, the very fact that we can get nerdy about coordinates and exact geographic directions and placements, sorry, is because we are cartophilic nuts. Map Corner is our podcast. It's a podcast dedicated to the love of maps and all things cartophilic. So if Pete is your prediction, folks, you're in the right place. Now, this week we have a theme. Claire, it's gender and geography, which you came up with.
Indeed.
A great alliteration. Now, why are we talking about gender and geography?
Well, it's soon International Women's Day, the beginning of March, and I thought it would be an interesting one to look at, partly because in doing kind of a year's worth of background map finding research, interviewee hunting and so on for the podcast, I can't help but observe that the cartographic field and things associated with that are quite blokey on the whole. Not entirely, and there are some obviously notable and amazing exceptions, but that's fine. It's what people, what floats people's boat, but it would be nice to big up the women a bit. So prepare to be taken down with a patriarchy as I control the entire podcast from here on in. I'm only joking. You've done more prep than me.
I believe the youth of today call it a sausage fest or a sausage party. It's just full of blokes, isn't it? This field, fundamentally, if it's not full of blokes, it feels like it is. Historically, it definitely has been. Yeah. But we can talk about maybe some of the reasons why that is a little bit later. Folks, don't forget to review us on Apple iTunes. It's a great way for us to expand our listenership. That's what it does. If you go onto Apple Podcasts, go write us a review. And then if you send us a message via the website, go onto mapcorner.space. It's that funny URL. And then go onto contact us and just say, "Oi, Mush, we've written a review." And then we'll mention you on a forthcoming show.
So this episode, we have a call, just the one, from Pat in America. Don't forget to give us a call. Then you can get on next time. Perhaps you'll have views on the gender and geography issue for next time.
Potentially. A whole load of stereotypes are going to be dragged up, not even potentially, but actually looking at these studies. Give us your calls. We need your reactions to this month's show, but also to your observations and your questions to do with map-related trivia, travel and geographic observations. You can do that by going onto mapcorner.space and leaving us a message on SpeakPipe. It's a little red tab over on the right. We always start each show with an interview. And here is me speaking to Valerie Hudson from the Woman Stats Project, which began in 2001. Valerie, as a Brit over here in your wonderful country, I'm somewhat confused about presidential schools. Looking at the footer on your email, it doesn't half make for long reading. So what exactly is the Bush School? And what is your connection to it?
Yes, well, presidents in the United States are given a presidential library, if you will, because the National Records Act in the United States, mandates that there be an archive for each president's administration. Mm-hmm. And so presidents usually negotiate with typically universities in order to set up their presidential library. And so George Herbert Walker Bush, or Bush 41, as we call him here in the States, set up his library here at Texas A&M University. And along with the setting up the presidential library, presidents often decide that they're going to have a research center or some sort of, outreach or some initiative that goes along with the presidential library. And so Bush 41 decided that he wanted his legacy to be a school of public service. That is a school that would, put forward, generations of new leaders that were devoted to the cause of public service as he had been. And so right next to the presidential library for George Bush is his school, the Bush School of Government and Public Service.
You have a place in a project called the Woman Stats Project, which has been running since 2001. What is the Woman Stats Project?
Oh, well, I am glad you asked. Back when I was going through my graduate education in security studies and international relations, the idea that you would talk about women was really, really foreign. You could have taken every single class in my graduate school and you would have never known there were women on the planet Earth. So it was very much like these two spheres just did not intersect at all. And so in the late 1990s, I began to feel that that was wrong. And certainly there were other people in international relations also thinking that. But I and my co-author, who is actually a UK, works in the UK. She's at the University of Kent at Canterbury. Her name is Andrea Denbor. Andrea and I wrote a book that looked at how the alteration on a massive scale of China and India's sex ratios through the devaluation of female life, sex selective abortion, female infanticide, was actually creating and would create serious security concerns for those countries and for their region. And so that was our first sort of linkage between, so what's going on with women and what's happening with the nation state? Is there a linkage between the two? After the success of that book, I then began to ask, well, are there other forms of discrimination and oppression against women that haven't an effect on national security? And so I first decided I was, going to compile some data on women. And back in 2001, to be perfectly honest with you, there wasn't a heck of a lot. Certainly was not what we have today. So we began the Woman Stats Project, which was an attempt to chronicle and compile information about all lots of varieties of dimensions of women's situation, status, and security. And then we would be able to use that data and relate it to national security outcomes. So while we started with two KPIs and an Excel spreadsheet, we've now, you know, really gone beyond that.
Being a typical bloke and not necessarily thinking of the female perspective, and specifically to do the mapping, the only map that I was really aware of to do with anything to do with female gender was actually the female suffrage map, which shows you the years of which various countries have given women the vote. And you're completely right, you know, that our view of the world, let alone of the mapping of the world, is always from a male perspective. So looking at the content, the output that you guys have actually done doesn't half make for kind of scary viewing. So where it's the female genital cutting map, which I think you did in 2015, like the actual prevalence of that kind of barbaric institution, you know, I thought it was just the Horn of Africa, but it's much wider. So tell us about, before we get onto specific maps, tell us about your methodology, how you've actually worked. You said you started off with an Excel spreadsheet. The world has moved on considerably since then, I'm sure, as your expertise in this matter. But tell us about your methodology, and then maybe tell us also about your kind of editorial process as well.
Yeah, well, we've really grown from our early beginnings. I mean, we now, instead of two KPIs, we have 24. And instead of one country, we have 7 countries represented among our KPIs. And so, the data is really an adjunct to the research of the co-principal investigators of the project. So the data and the research kind of are feeding into each other constantly.
So you're actually going and doing the research as well. It's not as if you're taking published data, then just mapping that. You're actually going off and looking at specific issues to do with women and then doing the research on that and then mapping it.
Yeah. So what we do is, we've come up with over 300 variables that we think are important to understanding the situation of women. And a lot of these are variables that are not really looked at. So, for example, patrilocal marriage. How often is it that when a young woman is married, she goes and lives with her husband and his family, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly those kinds of societies have special challenges for women. So first out, we go and we compile all the existing data on the prevalence of patrilocal marriage. And as you can imagine, the statistics are very soft and squishy. And so then we have to triangulate that with other data about practices and laws and inheritances, you know, so that we get a better picture of the prevalence of patrilocal marriage. And then once we've kind of compiled everything that's existing, we probably go out and ask country experts for their opinion about whether patrilocal marriage is still prevalent, whether it's, you know, diminishing. So, you know, a combination of us going out and collecting data as well as compiling data, we then have a whole bunch of information. Then what we do is we create what we call a scale rubric, which is if we wanted to compare the prevalence of patrilocal marriage, could we come up with a 3 or 4 or 5 point scale that would allow us to compare countries? And once we have that, then we go into that big hunk of data, right? That big, you know, old treasure chest of data that we've collected and compiled, and we begin to scale that. Once we have those scales, then we can walk over to our map creator right there on site, and we can instantaneously create a map of the prevalence of patrilocal marriage. So we're actually, in terms of research, while we love all of our raw data on practices and laws and prevalences, what we really love is the scales that we've been able to create from all of that data, because it's the scales that then allow us to map.
Gotcha. And some of those scales have, for me anyway, are a little bit of a surprise. You know, living, being British and then living in the United States, you kind of think that on just about every scale, and let's put a loaded word, you know, the scales which are good, that, let's say, Britain or the United States would always be in the top percentile, but they're actually not.
No.
Yes, exactly. That was a real surprise for me. And actually, it's the Scandinavian countries and Australia and New Zealand that generally are the most open. So give us a sense of, let's say, a couple instances where America somewhat falls down and might surprise people, and then tell us specifically about the issues to do with that, issues to do with women then afterwards.
Sure. Well, one where the US really falls down on, and I don't think it's very much of a surprise, is the high level of violence against women. And you know, in comparison with, as you say, countries in Scandinavia, even though countries in Scandinavia do have violence against women, America looks, you know, really not very good. Mm-hmm. So that's probably one that might be a surprise to Americans when they looked at a global map and they discovered that their country is, you know, not at the lower end, but more at the higher end. There are also some other surprises that I think you might find. So, for example, cousin marriage, right? Mm-hmm. The United States has no federal law against cousin marriage, and there are many states in the union that allow cousin marriage, while there are other states in the union that don't allow cousin marriage. And so the picture for cousin marriage in America is quite diverse. And so America looks different on that map than a number of other countries in the OECD might look. Another place is prevalence of polygyny. So while polygyny is illegal in the United States, enclaves of polygyny are tolerated in the United States. And therefore, the United States might look a little worse on that map than most Americans might assume.
So tell us about your methodology to do with the scales, per se, because what I'm looking at is one of the things which us map heads, us cartophiles absolutely love, isn't just looking at the shape of the globe rendered flat on a piece of paper, but it's also like the colours used. But where the colours are important here is exactly what you said before, is the scales. So tell us kind of the methodology of working out the scales and then flesh it out with a real example for us.
Well, that question actually shows that you really know what you're talking about, because that's the magic, right? The scales are actually where all of the action is. And usually when, you know, I present to a more naive audience, they just sort of take it for granted and nobody ever asks me about the scales. Mm-hmm. But you are absolutely right. Which is,
I tell you what, Valerie, you are going about things the right way. You are flattering the host of the podcast. Well done. We'll have you back. Don't worry.
Well, okay. But you are right that it's a science and an art to make a scale. Because what you're looking at for a scale is that it has to be conceptually meaningful, conceptually valid. And at the same point, from a data sense, it's got to be fairly reliable and replicable.
Yeah.
And that's often tough when you're talking about things that have to do with women. Because a lot of times the data, hard data about what's going on with women, is completely missing. One of my graduate students is currently writing an article. We had her scaling the prevalence of rape across the 176 countries in our report. And you might think to yourself, well, rape is a crime, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have hard crime statistics about rape. Ha, 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 ha. No, you are not. In fact, there were approximately 80 countries for which it was almost impossible to get any understanding of what the prevalence of rape was in the society. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you know, the reported rape rates don't look anything like the estimated rape rates. So you're dealing with a subject that is extremely hard, right, to come up with a hard numeric scale for. And that's one of the reasons, since the data on women is just so awful, that we went to an ordinal scale, right, where we're making sort of broad brush distinctions between nations. Usually our scales are 3-point or 5-point scales. Those are the majority of our scales. And we feel that that allows us to have a sense of both conceptual validity along with reliability and replicability. Oftentimes we have what we call univariate scales, which mm-hmm. are scales that are merely on one particular phenomenon, such as female genital cutting. But even with female genital cutting, you have to have two dimensions in your scale. You have to ask, is this legal or illegal? Because that tells you something. Mm-hmm. And then secondarily, you want to know, what are the estimates of the prevalence? What percentage of women in the population are likely to have been cut? So even within a univariate scale, such as female genital cutting, you've got you may have two dimensions going on. When you have a multivariate scale, which we consider to be our crown jewels, simply because it takes us blood, sweat, and tears to create a multivariate scale. Suppose mm-hmm. you're interested in the overall physical security of women. Well, you're going to want to look at things like domestic violence. You're going to want to look at things like rape. You're going to want to look at things like femicide. You're going to want to look at a lot of different kinds and forms of violence against women, each of which is going to have data problems, right? Mm-hmm. And then somehow you've got to put it together into a conceptually valid scale that allows you to say, well, you know, suicide may be a huge thing in this country, but there's very little femicide, you know, so how does that balance out? You know, how do you have different countries that have different problems and compare them in a meaningful sense? And that, I think, is both an art and a science to do that. But you are right. In fact, if you and I were, you know, sort of sitting down together in the same place, what uh-huh. you and I would be looking at is our code book that explains the scaling rubrics and justifies them and shows how that we've attempted to make them reliable and replicable. That's where the magic is.
Without wanting to put too fine a point on it, as I said, because you can look at these maps at womanstats.org, and it does make for interesting, fascinating, and illuminating viewing and reading. Have you done a compendium, almost like a global map, you know, to show overall which countries are better for women, still have a way to go, et cetera, et cetera? Is there like a catch-all overall, and there's like global map of the statistics and the data which you've uncovered?
Yeah, no superstructure there, because I think it really depends on what you think the major subordinating mechanisms for women are. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I have a bad physical security of women country, you know, like mm-hmm. the United States, which is really, I mean, it's
and
not
that,
the
and
first,
that was the, that's, and one of the maps worst. Which really, really surprised me, that
right.
one.
But then they have lots of legal protections for women. Women's property rights are protected. Mm-hmm. There's no female genital cutting. There's not a whole lot of polygyny. I mean, you know what I mean? So we have not yet come to the position where we could say where that country ranks, right, in terms of how bad or how worse it is than another country that might have better physical security of women, but really, you know, like Saudi Arabia, right? Women can't drive. Women can't travel without permission. Women have very little property rights, right? So how do you trade off violence and, say, the ability to be something other than a legal minor under your system's law? So you're right. We're not there yet, because mm-hmm. I don't know how to compare differences on these variety of dimensions.
Okay. If there were two data sets that you're most proud of in the time that you guys have been compiling these, what would it be and why?
It's our crown jewels. It's our multivariate scales. There's no one else that
okay.
has an overall
yeah, can't
physical
talk to
security
me about your scales again, Valerie. You have to say you've got to go for like a couple of maps Just give me a couple of maps.
Yeah. All right. So this one. The second one I'm really, really proud of is inequity in family law. Nobody else has an overall scale of how inequitable family law is for women. And we look at all sorts of things. We look at divorce and child custody and property rights and, you know, you name it. Mm-hmm. And that's a really stunning map. And furthermore, that map is not just in law, but in practice. So in addition to asking what the law is like, we also ask, is the law actually obeyed, right? Which is the farther shore that you always have to ask concerning women. You know, there may be wonderful laws on the books, but everybody knows that on the ground, you know, a woman cannot expect that law to be enforced. A great example, of course, is India. Sex selective abortion has been completely illegal and criminalized since 1994, right? But the sex ratio in India is now worse than it has ever been in recorded history. So obviously people are not obeying the law. So that inequity in family law and practice, I think, is just a gigantic contribution looking at how inequitable the law is and also, you know, what the situation of women on the ground. And then lastly, the scale that underpins our forthcoming book from Columbia University Press called The First Political Order, How Sex Shapes Governance and National Security Worldwide, is what we call the patrilineal fraternal syndrome, where we take 11 subordinative mechanisms concerning women, including women's property rights, polygyny, patrilocal marriage, bride price and dowry, sex ratio alteration, just the most subordinative practices at, of all, and say, where do countries rank on that scale? So those are the three that I want you to look at when you go to our maps page.
Well, you've obviously done a few of these before, Valerie, interviews, that is, because not maps. You've done a whole load of maps, but interviews, because you're nicely starting to wrap things up by talking about the book. That's going to be my next question. So tell us about the book that you guys actually have out. How long has that been in conception, gestation, and birth?
Oh, thank you. Yes, you know, perhaps it's only for women authors, I don't know, but every book feels like a very long pregnancy, a very long gestation, and then you finally get that baby. So we're kind of at almost the 9-month mark with the latest book. That is, it's coming out in March 2020, so we're almost there. We just did the copy edits, so we're ready for birth. And it's actually, it's kind of our magnum opus here at the Woman Stats Project. We had 4 years of funding from the U.S. Department of Defense under their Minerva Initiative. They reached out to social scientists to, you know, authorize certain kinds of research. And the Department of Defense wanted to know whether we could actually demonstrate in rigorous statistical fashion whether there was, in fact, a linkage between the subordination of women and the insecurity of their nation states. So they gave us a big pot of money and we went to town. We had like 30 graduate and undergraduate students working for us. Mm-hmm. We worked solid for 4 years. And we have put together what we consider to be a pretty definitive case that what you do to women is what you end up doing to your nation state. So if you curse and subordinate women, you are going to end up with a cursed and insecure nation. So that's coming out in March. We also have two other books that have been very well received. Sex and World Peace, which we published in 2012. Is again, it's sort of an overview of the extent to which women still face oppression and subordination worldwide and how that affects their countries. And then another book that we put out was called The Hillary Doctrine, where we looked at Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's 4 years in that office and asked what she was able to accomplish for women and what she was not able to accomplish for women and what we learned from her experience.
Here's a question for you, Prof. Is there any correlation between a country having an elected female head of the executive? Gotta be careful, not necessarily head of state. Okay, so we're not talking about queens per se, and its treatment of women.
No, but if you turn to the legislature, there is some evidence. Mm-hmm. That is to say, most female chief executives are still coming to power in nations where there is not a tradition of female leadership. And as such, we don't see any sort of marked change in their kind of approach to, say, foreign affairs or things of that nature. But what we find in with legislatures is if you start getting a critical mass of women, so if you get above 30%, mm-hmm. You start getting a change in the proportion of legislation that deals with things such as welfare issues, anti-corruption issues, legal protections for citizens. Those kinds of things are much more emphasized in legislatures where females have a greater share of representation.
Professor Valerie M. Hudson, thank you for coming on to Map Corner and fleshing out, illuminating, enlightening and educating us about the inequities that women face throughout the globe and how it can be mapped out.
Oh, you can tell people that all of our data and all of our maps are freely available on our website. If you want to use our maps, you go right ahead. We have very nice high resolution PDF maps that are downloadable from our website. We also have what's called a map creator, so that if you needed a customized color set, so for example, for our book, we needed grayscale maps, you can use our map creator to create the maps in any color scheme that you would like. Thank you very much for having me.
It was an utter pleasure to speak to Valerie. She has a wonderful title. She's a university distinguished professor, not even a professor, but you know, a distinguished one, and that is her title. And she's the director of Women, Peace and Security at the Department of International Affairs down there in Texas A&M University. Proper prof she is, and it was actually lovely to speak to. Go on to womanstats.org to go and have a look at all of their research and all of their maps. It's an utter treasure trove if you are into maps and mapping, and if you're not, why are you listening to this podcast? So just go there. So Moving on from Texas, we go up to Kielder, which is in the north of England. This is Glyn and his audio postcard.
Hello to all at Map Corner. It's Glyn here. I'm calling in from London, where it's a clear night. As I was walking home this evening, I could clearly see the moon and the constellation of Orion and a few other stars. But this time last week, I was a little bit further north, 55.2 degrees north and 2.6 degrees west, to be more precise, at the Kielder Observatory, the Kielder Dark Zone in Northumberland. It was a cold and blustery night, quite cloudy, but when the clouds parted, then you really could see the night sky in all its glory. I've never seen stars so bright or so numerous. Not only could you see Orion, but you could also clearly see the colours of the stars of Orion and the Horsehead Nebula in Orion's belt, not to mention the nearby Pleiades. The observatory is set on a hill surrounded by forest, and the dark zone is enhanced by there being very little artificial light in the surrounding area. It's sparsely populated, but there are also no illuminated road signs and no street lighting for miles around. It's certainly a very special place to visit. The observatory is near Kielder Water, which is the largest man-made lake by volume in the United Kingdom, created in the 1970s by the damming of the River North Tyne. And there are many features of interest around the lake for the map enthusiast. There are roads that appear from nowhere and then slide back under the waters a little bit further along, and a disused railway line that does the same thing. No villages were actually flooded to create the reservoir, but a number of farms were lost. And at the west end of the lake, there's a village called Buttery Hall, which is clearly relatively recent, and when you look at it on a map, it looks like a planned village. And I did wonder whether that was created for the residents of farms that were lost, but apparently that's not the case. It was created for workers of the Forestry Commission when the area around there was developed as the Kielder Forest. It's certainly a very beautiful area. There are many opportunities for leisure. When they developed Kielder Water, they created paths and trails. There's a path that runs all the way round the lake, which is suitable for both walking and cycling. Apparently, 250,000 people visit there every year, but on a cold January afternoon, my wife and I walked 6.5 miles without meeting a soul.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I have been to the Lake District years ago, which I, one of the things I remember most about that holiday actually is that the car exploded halfway up the M6 and we had to be rescued and given a hire car to carry on the journey. But it was a really beautiful, beautiful area. We were really lucky with the weather as well, actually, because I think it's not always pleasant. And it's a very great place for intrepid outdoorsy types, which I wouldn't necessarily say that I am, but fortunately I didn't have to be too intrepidly outdoorsy for the time that we were staying there. But the whole area is, you know, is rightfully thought of as, you know, one of the most beautiful parts of Britain.
I've spent precious little time kind of in the Lake District, Peak District. This is where my kind of urban roots, my urban natural habitat, you know, belies the fact that the old swathes of England, which I haven't really visited. And it's definitely somewhere where friends, family, acquaintances who've been always just, you know, marvel at the beauty of it and stuff. So I'm going to have to right this wrong, this big omission, sometime soon. We talked about travelling up and down motorways. And I remember, Claire, being, don't know, between the ages of definitely, let's say, 6 or 7, my dad, me, would sit me in the passenger seat in the front of the car. This is bearing in mind that this was the 1970s when it was legal for 6, 7, 8-year-old kids to be in the front of cars. And he would hand me a map and he would say, get us from Birmingham to London. And that is one of the key kind of seminal things of my childhood, was feeling like I was navigating and understanding that map. Let's just wind back, because we're talking about gender and geography in this edition of Map Corner. And there are stereotypes around who's into maps, which gender is best understands maps, and how they even give instructions on directions. So my kind of first foray really into reading a map was those trips down to London. Remind us how you became a lover of maps.
I got it from my dad because he's a real map fiend as well. But actually, I used to love everyone had one of those big road maps in the back of the car or underneath the seat or in the seat pocket on the back of one of the front seats of the car. Actually, that's where I remember it being when I was a kid. I would pull it out during journeys and follow the route that we were traveling, or just look at bits of the map. I can remember many a happy time spent in the back of the car as a child, just, you know, scooting around the map and looking at different bits of the country. You know, I just always really enjoyed putting yourself in a place, really having an understanding of where I was in relation to everything else. I think that's, I don't know, maybe there's something very reassuring about that. You're not just on some random road and you don't know where you are or where you're going. You can see where you are and work it out and see how it relates to other things. Or even, are we nearly there yet? Well, you can tell if you're looking at the map, because you can see how far you've got left to go. So that has been enjoyable for me. And I still do have a big map in my car. I don't always pull it out, but I quite enjoy it occasionally when I do.
What you've described there is a spatial awareness. And that is the key difference, scientists think, that there is between the male brain and the female brain. Everything is on a bell curve. All abilities, all human abilities are on a bell curve. So, of course, there are going to be women who are better at map reading than some men. But if you take the average man, the average women, men have the ability to picture themselves almost in an abstract sense within a space, and then they can project that onto a map. Thinking about this purely anecdotally, my mother, when we were driving to places, not that she was bad at navigating, if we were going somewhere new, always wanted to ask people for directions. I'm sure my family was hardly unique in this.
Yeah, I think it's, isn't it kind of quite a cliche that men are not very good at asking for directions and women are more willing to. But I think, you know, like you're saying, that people's ability to manage the spatial awareness, I think, you know, there's more and more evidence now that that's basically practice rather than what's innate. And so there's a lot of scientific thinking that actual spatial awareness is developed like any other muscle. Doing things and playing with toys as a child that develop spatial awareness, and that different types of skills get developed in different ways. And we will hopefully see a more equal dealing with that, but you know, it's cultural perhaps rather than cognitive, but it doesn't mean that it's not something that does happen.
And I was thinking of that. So when I was reading these studies earlier on, and I was really looking at that element, which is, if you say to somebody that you are good at this, or you should be good at this, or you are bad at this, you get positive or negative kind of reinforcement. And how much of me being age 7 and being given that map was me wanting that map, or my father reinforcing that I should be able to read the map? And if I'd have been a girl, the chances are my dad, as progressive as he was back then, wouldn't have put me in the front of the car and thrown me the map and said, read.
In fact, I wasn't asked to do that as a small child either. I just took the map because I was interested in it. Although there was a time when my dad did throw me a map and ask me to navigate when we were driving through southern France and I would have been, I don't know, probably about 18 or 19, something like that. And I nearly caused us to have this terrible crash because I told him to take the first exit off the roundabout, forgetting that we were going to go the other way round the roundabout because we were in France. So he was in this lane. I was like, and he said, are you sure? Are you sure it's that? Because I think he had an instinct that it wasn't that way, because he appreciated as a driver that he was going that way around the roundabout, and I hadn't really thought about that. I just looked at the map and saw that it was the kind of the first, what would have been on a British map, the first exit off the roundabout. Yeah, and the problem was we were in a two-car convoy and the others were following us. So it was a bit of a problem, but I think that's about the only time I've got it horribly wrong. And I always like find it really satisfying when I can kind of trust my instinct sometimes. If I'm in a town I know kind of well but in different bits, and I, you know, the first time you drive all the way through somewhere because that you've never done before, I find that really nice and satisfying.
Even when you can't quite orientate yourself, or you go into somewhere which is new, you just know from the position of the sun, you go, well, okay, I'm heading west now, or I'm heading east. But these are all things before we had mobile phones. Now we have phones and we have kind of maps on them. You know, it's not that it's impossible to get lost, but it is infinitely harder to get lost now when we all have these supercomputers in our pocket or on our dashboards of our cars.
But I don't know how long, because I resisted having a sat nav for a really long time. Were you an early adopter? I guess you might have been.
No, I wasn't, because I haven't had that many cars in my adult life. I fundamentally only had 2/3. And there's been massive gaps between me having them. So, because living in London, didn't really need a car.
Well, of course,
But one of the things which I read on the studies, which I thought was really interesting, apart from apparently there being some basis of difference between the male and the female brain, which I think then is definitely, I think, then I completely agree with you, is then compounded by cultural norms, is how men and women actually give directions. There is a difference where men are much more clinical in terms of, so you go down this road, first on the left, second on the right type of thing. Or Americans talk about blocks, you know, three blocks down and whatever. Women notice landmarks and will say, you get to this place and then you'll see a street next to it. And there were loads of studies that actually say that women are much better at landmarks and geographic peculiarities than men. They have a better eye, whereas men, it's almost like they've stripped away the extraneous detail and they're just giving you it in almost like an Excel spreadsheet way. And that's what I saw in these studies all the time.
I think that makes sense, because I think if I were giving directions, I would throw in some landmarks. Because I think it's really easy sometimes if you're driving around to like just miss. If you're counting streets, it's quite easy to miss one and you go completely wrong. But if you can only turn at the street that's opposite the big church or something, then it's obvious which one that is.
It makes complete sense. But the one thing I think we have to recognise is that, and you railed against it at the start of the show, didn't you? You were like, oh, down with the patriarchy and whatever. And there is no two ways about it, but in the world of exploration and mapping, this has been a male preserve. You know, it's men that have gone out and done the exploring and the conquering, the discovering, sailing on ships, and in the European perspective, you know, founding colonies. First off, you know, the men do all the swashbuckling stuff, and then the women kind of like bring up the rear. So it was really good to dig in, do a little bit of research, and find famous or maybe not so famous intrepid female explorers. And the first one that I came by was Gudrid, and her surname starts with Thor. Then after that, folks, I give up, right? But she was an Icelandic badass from circa 980. It was on that first expedition from Iceland to Greenland. And the amazing thing is about her story is that you think now that a lot of people are very mobile and travel the globe. But she was born in Iceland, went to Greenland. She gave birth to the first European to be born in North America. Wow. Did you say that Greenland isn't North America? No, technically it is. But you know, she went to Greenland with that first expedition, had a son, and she was really key in trying to set up that colony. The Vikings get a bad rap, but for their time, they were quite egalitarian. You know, women could be warriors and women could go and sail on ship and discover stuff. But the amazing thing is about her, so she's born in Iceland in 980. She goes off to Greenland, then Vinland, so North America. And before she dies, she converts to Catholicism and she goes to Rome. I cannot conceive of that life, what she must have seen in a world without the internet and TV and photographs, to be somebody who's born in rural Iceland, to have gone to Greenland to try and set up that colony, and then to go and meet the Pope before you die. You just cannot conceive of such a life.
That's a lot of travel at that era as well, you know.
That is a lot of travel. And we're talking about just wind power. There's no steam power paddling you along at a faster clip. And she is written about in the Icelandic sagas. She really has a place in Icelandic mythology. Yeah, another kind of notable explorer who I came by was Jeanne Barre, and she was French. So she's in the 1740s, in the age of pirates, and she wanted to circumnavigate the world. And back then, the French Navy said women just were not allowed to get on ships, period, full stop. So she had to disguise herself as a bloke. And, you know, you always hear these kind of pirate stories and stuff. And there's, you know, there's always somebody claiming to be a teenage boy, isn't there? Who's actually a girl who's kind of like kind of stowed away. She was the original one. She actually did it and managed to circumnavigate the world. Though her story gets a little bit kind of confused because as to when she was actually discovered. But she was discovered before the ship came back to France, that actually she had bound her breasts and actually she was actually female. But she came back somewhat of a hero. Again, I just can't imagine the lengths that she must have gone just to hide her gender. Because I'm thinking back then, the whole toilet part of things was a pretty public thing. You literally
not
just
a lot
put
of personal space on a ship.
Not really. Literally, what people did was just put their backsides out of a window, didn't they? Out of a porthole, and you just did your business. You know. So how she managed to even disguise that for any manner of time, heaven only knows. But she did. Those early female travelers and explorers had so many things to get over, on top of the inherent lack of technology of the time and how dangerous it would have been to travel. And it's kind of one of the problems when we look at exploration, we look at it very much through a Western lens. So if you're just going to do the most cursory of Google searches, invariably these are British, French, Australian, Dutch, German women, Austrian women who traveled. These aren't African women or Asian women, because European culture, in effect, is what's actually mapped the world. And I know we've kind of talked about this before through the Polynesians and kind of travel. Western means of mapping the world and traveling and traversing the globe have become the standard. It's been written that this is kind of what's happened. And with that in mind, women of colour are scantly kind of like represented on this list. You know, those stories and their stories must be out there are just utterly lost to us.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that's, you know, there are a number of factors, isn't there, about the kind of presence of women cartographers or explorers or whatever. And partly it's partly it's about kind of education and where people's interests are pushed, but it's also about who's remembered, So that there are, when you go digging for them, there are those role models out there, but it takes a lot of digging. So I found a story about a native Canadian Beothuk tribes person called Shanordithit, who was one of the last of her tribe in the early 1800s. And she was a map maker. And that tribe was one of the very first tribes to develop any contact with Europeans in the 1500s, actually, gave rise to the concept of a red Indian, because they were using red colouring, a dye and colouring on their skin. She did these amazing maps to map out the history and the kind of geography of her tribe, and she was about the last one of it. And if it wasn't for her, we would have very little of some of that. And these are not people who've always made the narrative in the places, because, you know, 19th century Canada was not a place for native women, particularly. It's only later that people have gone back and found those stories.
And one of the things about the whole world of mapping and discovery is that those kind of inherent cultural biases against women being able just to travel. You still have in Saudi Arabia, I think the law was changed last year, the year before, that a woman couldn't travel without a male in her family signing and saying she could actually leave the country. And, you know, that's 2019. So if you're talking about, I don't know, 1832, to see Isabella Bird, who traveled by herself throughout North America, Hawaii, Japan, Korea, China, Vietnam. The cultural shock of, number one, a woman wanting to do that. Then number two, a woman turn up on her own in these places, which then would have been incredibly remote and not connected to each other, must have been utterly profound. This is a white woman, a white person, sorry, in rural China in the middle of the 19th century. And then this white person was a woman. So you really do have to applaud the bravery of these women that went out to see the world and to see it on their own terms. Where are you going on holiday this year, Claire?
Oh, I don't know. We haven't really decided yet. Possibly
anywhere?
France or Spain, possibly.
All right. Nowhere particularly far-flung?
No, well, we did far-flung last year, to be fair. I've got to keep my carbon footprint down now.
Hmm. So where did you go last year?
Went to Australia last year.
Oh, of course. Crumbs. And we came with you. Queensland and Perth.
I did check some postcards.
You did. And whilst you were travelling, and you were travelling, let's say, north to south, did you ever turn the map upside down?
Not that I remember, but I know I have done it. I'd say one of the things I don't like now about when you can follow a map on your phone is sometimes it doesn't always do that naturally. I don't know. I sometimes find following a map on my phone when I'm walking through a city especially not a very fantastic experience. And those are the times when I'd rather have a paper map sometimes, because you can see more detail and you can hold it any which way you like as well, which also helps. So. Have I turned a map upside down?
I have. The older I get, I will admit, the more I'm prone just to turn it upside down. Something I didn't even ever think of doing when I was much younger. But the whole Google Maps thing and having walking directions is fraught, because if you are driving, let's say if you are heading in the wrong direction from what the directions are telling you, you realize very quickly. You realize very quickly because that blue line keeps on extending and you're going the wrong way. If you're walking, because you're walking at a much slower speed, you can be walking for a good 3 or 4 minutes before you realize I'm walking in the wrong direction.
Yes.
And Google are trying to fix that. And there is some kind of spatial map thing that they do now that I'm trying to do this from memory, because I realized I was in San Francisco and I need to have walking directions about 3 months ago somewhere. And there's this new thing which very clearly said, you are facing this way. I was like, oh, all right, because it knows that this is actually an inherent problem from walking instructions, because the GPS isn't actually that correct. So you can be going, as I said, a good couple of minutes or so before you realise actually you're in the wrong direction. But you know what we should do, though, Claire? Before we witter on any more about women and mapping, we should maybe hear from our one female caller. It's Pat, who is responding to a call from last month.
Hi, this is Pat calling from 4149 North, 8157 West, which is Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Everyone mentioned beautiful Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, so I'd like to add my pitch for cemeteries as parks and public green spaces. Unlike British churchyards, the great rural, well, now urban, cemeteries of the United States started with the intention to keep them quite park-like. The first of these was Mount Auburn Cemetery in Boston, started in 1831 when there was some risk that Boston Common was going to be developed. That was well before Central Park. I've lived in both Buffalo and Cleveland and know their beautiful cemeteries the best. Forest Lawn in Buffalo was founded in 1849. The model was the Père Lachaise Cemetery, which is on an estate outside Paris. Forest Lawn's a beautiful place full of rolling hills, lovely ponds, and winding roadways intended for a Sunday afternoon carriage ride and picnic. It's almost folded into the Buffalo Park system, which was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted. President Millard Fillmore is buried there. My husband's family goes way back in Buffalo history, so we have our spots picked out under some big trees on top of a hill where, as my mother-in-law says with satisfaction, will drain onto the people lower down. In Cleveland, I love a stroll or drive around Lakeview Cemetery, founded in 1869. There's a grand tomb and memorial to President James Garfield, and Wade Memorial Chapel was designed by Louis Comfort Tiffany. Stone-cutting artisans came from Italy to work on the monuments at Lakeview, so we have the cemetery to thank for a still thriving Little Italy neighborhood just down the hill. Both Forest Lawn and Lakeview are still open to the public and offer history tours, concerts, and other community events, and they're just great places to stroll through the trees, ponds, and gardens, and commune with the people of the past.
Ooh, 2 minutes. Thanks, Pat. Slightly caught you out there, Pat, but thank you for that lovely call.
Indeed. Mm. Have you chosen your burial spot, Royfield?
I have some ridiculously romantic notion, and it's going to involve a whole load of effort by my nearest and dearest. So I'm going to have to revise it and revise it down.
Are you a buried at sea person? I've researched that, and that is a lot of work.
Well, no. Well, I want to be cremated because I don't see the point of having my body just like hang around and kind of decompose. When you're dead, you're dead. I'm just like, burn me to a crisp. I'm quite happy with that. This used to be my notion. I haven't thought about this in a little while, actually. But I used to say I wanted to be cremated and have my ashes, part of them spread in Birmingham, the other half in London, in Notting Hill, and then the other half, and then the other third.
How many halves have you got?
Well, exactly. I did correct myself afterwards. And then another third in Jamaica. But now I'd want to be quartered, so to speak. Not quite home drawn and quartered, but because I'd go, well, I have so much love for California that I don't. But it's just nonsense. It's never going to happen. So I don't know. Wherever I drop down dead.
There's one aspect that is going to happen, Royfield. It happens to all of us.
Well, no.
So I know what you mean.
Wherever I drop down dead, burn me there and scatter my ashes there. But
fair enough.
Yeah. So that's me. What about you?
Well, I am registered to donate my body to medical science for the use of medical students. My granddad did it, and then he died at 92, 93, about 5 years ago now. And because we knew he'd always wanted to do this, yeah, it was quite easy to sort out, actually. And after that, we had a memorial service in the church, and he's got a kind of bench in the churchyard and stuff. His body went off to a university, and that's what he wanted. And actually, since then, I've registered to do it, and also other people in my family have registered to do it as well. So I had a quite complicated conversation with the organ donor service this last week, because the law's changing over here that there's a presumption in favour of donation, but you can't do both. You can either donate your whole self And if they don't want me, then they can have any organ they like. But the medical school gets first dibs, and the new donor arrangements don't cope with that scenario brilliantly well. You can cut all this out. This is not interesting.
No. It's absolutely fascinating. And actually, it shows you how inconsistent my thinking has actually been on this whole what happens when I die thing. Because I used to have an organ donor card in the 80s and the 90s in my wallet all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask me, do I want to donate my organs after I die? I'd go, yes. Then you ask me, how do I want to, what do I want to happen to my body after I die? Then I go, cremated. It's only now that I've actually put the two things together, actually listening to you. The only interesting thing that I heard the other day, a friend of mine was saying, and she's a nurse in kind of management over here. And she said to me that when people donate their organs, they presume, they think, they wish, they hope that it's going to be the corneas on their eyes. It's going to be their heart. It's going to be a sexy organ. And she says, you know what it is most of the time? It's like tendons.
Oh.
It's, yeah, she said it's very prosaic bits of your body, which you wouldn't think. So it's like tendons in knees and in ankles and things like that, that actually really do get donated. And of course, you don't hear about that.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of the time, it's those boring bits that we've got. It's not the eyes. It's not the heart, etc. That's what we want to donate. But yeah, well done to your grandpops. Was he an Asprey?
No, he was a Keech. Yeah, it's my maternal granddad. So
that is a wonderful surname, as in Stacey Keach, the actor, the old actor.
Oh, I don't know. There, I think it's not an unusual name in the area, but in fact, our hospice in the Bedfordshire is Keach Cottage Hospice. I don't think that's any relation to me, but there are a number of Keaches around in this area.
I'm sure that it actually is related to you. You just need to go back far enough to find,
I suppose, yeah,
find the link. You know, if a name is clustered in an area, well, it almost definitely is related to you. But anyway,
yeah.
I digress. We're keeping this show nice and tight this week. So it's gender and geography. So I'm presuming, Claire, that you're going to come out with your map fact, which is gender and geography laden.
Well, now you say that, and there are some marvellous gender-related map facts, but then I saw this one and I couldn't resist it. And it is that jigsaw puzzles were invented in the 1760s, and the first jigsaw puzzles were all maps. Like, that's what they did. That's what the jigsaw puzzle was. And then they were put a map on a piece of board and cut it into bits, and they used it to teach people geography by asking them to reassemble it. And that really spoke to me, because I had a number of map jigsaws when I was younger. In fact, I think we still have one somewhere. And there's something really fun about a map jigsaw, because, again, it's like putting the world to rights, isn't it, when you put it all in the right place. But I had no idea that it wasn't like we had picture jigsaws at the start. Jigsaws were invented in order to teach people geography by putting maps on them. That was a way of learning about the world. And I suppose that a kind of a women-related, well, gender-related map fact from that is that I saw some amazing stuff around from the sort of late 1800s to the mid-1900s. So it's a very big fashion for girls to do globes and embroidery maps, needlework maps. And in fact, I think Catherine Rowan Jones shared some of these early on in the podcast. And interestingly enough, because of the patriarchy, they were never really considered as sort of worth studying as maps, although they were quite a substantial contribution to the kind of geographical awareness of a whole family, where they had a embroidered map or globe. So it was often a kind of real kind of contribution to society where those were done. So there's your gender-related map fact, but I couldn't resist the jigsaws because it was such a fun fact.
Absolutely, it was a fun fact, and I properly learnt something there. What's been happening on the socials in the last month?
Interestingly enough, on the Twitters, Catherine Rowan Jones has sent us a picture of a stick map, which again is like the seafaring navigation tools which we discussed last time, and it's just a thing of beauty. It's sticks and tiny shells, sort of laying out, I guess, currents and islands and so on. It's just so impressive. So that was one that was really interesting in the on the Twitters. In terms of the Facebook group, the most sort of engaged with post was the one that you did, Royfield, around encouraging people to share the outlines of countries and guess what they are. So that got a lot of feedback and interest. And we've had some really interesting discussions on that group.
Mm. We need to breathe life back into that thread, though. I kind of saw that as the ideal thread just to keep running and running. However, Yokel Bear, black marks for you, sir, right? By he threw in a made-up place, didn't he? I can't remember. It was Middle Earth or something or another.
That is a bit hard. That's a bit unfair.
Very unfair, very unfair. You know, I started out with the outline of Mongolia, and I thought, you know, this will sort out the wheat from the chaff. And of course, the very first person who responded got it within like 3 minutes, and
they're smart people, these Map Corner folks. Yeah.
Until Yokel Bear comes along and completely utterly flonks everybody, and then says, "Oh yeah, it's made up, this one." Yeah, so anyway.
So we've had some really, we've had quite a lot of people sharing lots of different things about languages, the real basic sort of things to understand about when you go to France, which cheek do you kiss first? So we have Ken McDonald to thank for that. So that if I do go to France on holiday, I'll at least be able to look at the map and know which way to head for in terms of kissing the locals. That would be important. I think one that got some interesting...
Would you remember which local you've actually kissed? Because I know this is an issue for you, isn't it?
I mean, I was talking about sort of general sort of greetings in the French style. So,
as opposed to your first kiss, which you can't remember who that was.
Yeah. Unromantic soul as I am. Well, that's not entirely fair, but there you go. Actually, and another kind
of... You said it, not me, you know. I didn't call you an unromantic soul. You're having a conversation with yourself here, Mrs. I'm just an innocent bystander. Anyway.
So, yeah, but I mean, I suppose also we had a really great post from Michelle Green, which was about tattoos on the hands of Samoan women, which, again, is around bringing together the themes of gender and the kind of seafaring maps and the kind of brilliant... navigational skills of Pacific Islanders. It just shows how the women held a lot of navigational prowess in that culture. So again, our understanding of who's good at maps is very culturally specific. Mm-hmm. That was one to watch, and that's a really interesting article around that as well. So as we go into an interesting time for the world, we've seen our first coronavirus map posted to the Facebook group, so I think that's definitely something that we will follow up on next month to see where things are at.
I think that'd be a very, very, very wise and appropriately time-sensitive thing for us to do. So are we just about done? Can we start to fold up our maps?
Fold up our maps.
Well, don't forget, folks, just before we completely and utterly go, mapcorner.space, that is the website where you can go and catch up with all the back episodes of the show. You can also write comments on previous episodes there. You can go onto Facebook, type in Map Corner, and you'll find a nice little thriving community of mapaholics, cartophiles on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter, where I'm at Royfield. And Claire, where are you?
I'm at Claire J. Asterbury.
And the hashtag, if you have anything clever, interesting or confounding to do with the world of geography and mapping, is hashtag Map Corner. Have I forgotten anything, Claire, or can we just skedaddle?
I think we're ready to fold up our maps.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.